It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, in some communities, neighborhood streets have been opened up to bikes and pedestrians during the COVID-19 outbreak. We'll find out what's happening in places like Milwaukee, Madison, and elsewhere, thanks to some city partnerships. First, we'll take a look at protest-related news later in the program. Right now, we're taking a break to reminisce about some of the best moments in Wisconsin sports history. Most sports are on hold right now because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We're not sure when they'll be back in full swing. What we can do in the meantime is look back on some of our favorite memories. Our next guest put together his own list of the 50 greatest Wisconsin sports moments of the last 50 years, looking into how each one played out and the impact that it left. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite, most memorable Wisconsin sports moment? What made it special? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. J.R. Radcliffe is a trending sports reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He hosts the Journal Sentinel's Brewers podcast. His 50 in 50 series, plus a bonus list of 10 extra sports moments, recently wrapped up. J.R., welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being here.
Well, even when sports are happening, which they're mostly not, these kind of conversations, these reminiscences can be good starters for conversations. Is this something you found yourself doing even in normal times, trying to think of those great moments?
I definitely think it was one component of what my job is at the Journal Sentinel as the trending sports reporter, is kind of taking a historical spin at times usually through the lens of something that's just happened recently. You know, maybe the Brewers had a walk-off home run against the Cubs. You know, I've made a list of ranking all of the walk-off home runs against the Cubs. You know, nothing like twisting the knife into the Cubs fans a little bit too. So that is part of what my role has been at the Journal Sentinel. And so the historical stuff is certainly on my mind a lot. I've been following Wisconsin sports my whole life. And so this came kind of naturally. And when I was staring down what seemed like it was going to be a pretty long pause from regular sports competition, it seemed like the right time to maybe do a pretty big deep dive into some of the biggest moments in Wisconsin sports history and give each one kind of its own feature story.
Before we dig into each moment, what was your criteria? What did a moment have to do to lift itself above all others here?
Well, obviously when we're talking moments, there's a nebulous criteria because what you define as a moment could be, you know, an entire game. You know, winning a championship, winning a Super Bowl is certainly going to be way, way up there. But I did try to look at it more as a singular moment. So, certainly I broke my own rules a lot, but I did try to make it something that, and I even said this in the definition of the rules, something where you remember where you were when this thing happened. And that could be a big shot, a big home run. It could be a whole game, but something that really sticks out in your mind because you were there to witness it and you'll never forget where you were and the circumstances around it. I did sort of throw in caveats that it's Wisconsin sports teams and some Wisconsin sports athletes competing in individual competitions or international competitions with like Team USA, rather than athletes who are homegrown competing now in pro sports organizations that are outside Wisconsin. So I did try to narrow the scope that way a little bit. Threw in a couple moments that just plain old took place on Wisconsin soil, such as Tiger Woods announcing that he was turning pro at Brown Deer Park back in the late 90s. So that was the rough criteria. But, you know, I probably broke my own rules a couple times and tried to make this as fun as possible and not be too rigid with what I was trying to present.
JR, I'm going to be selfish and pick out a couple moments on your list that I remember where I was. The Aaron Rodgers Hail Mary against the Detroit Lions on Thursday Night Football. I have vivid memories of just like falling to my knees on the floor, like almost hyperventilating after that play. That was one of my more specific memories from your list. And the other one was a few years back, was on your list. I should have written the year down, the Bronson Koenig buzzer beater to get the Badgers into the Sweet 16. Watching with the family. And that was another just what did I just see kind of moment.
And both of those are interesting in that they're kind of similar. There wasn't, you know, that Badgers team overachieved. They beat a two seed in Xavier that year. They didn't go beyond, you know, they didn't go to the Final Four or anything. So it's kind of about the singularity of that moment. And same with the Hail Mary, which, again, I think everybody shares, you know, I think we all remember where we were when that happened. It's not like that team went on to make a deep run into the playoffs, go to the Super Bowl or anything like that. So it probably, both of those things probably lose a little steam because of that. but it's the singularity of that moment. And then that also makes it difficult because the scope of this has been the past 50 years. Well, things in the 1970s and 1980s weren't as universally televised as things that are, you know, in the last 20 years. So we maybe don't have a, you know, sort of singular experience of some moments that took place before we were all watching it on live television. You know, that some of the things from the 1980 Olympics that stick out, they happened on tape delay for people. Some people knew about it because they listened to it on the radio, but it wasn't that singular moment where everyone knows right where they were. Some of those things still made my list, but there's also that challenge and slightly weighing that, that maybe some of the more modern moments are a little bit more, you know, simply because we remember them, recency bias, but also because they're televised or broadcast in a way that some of the older ones weren't.
Talking to J.R. Radcliffe from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at great sports moments, 50 of them he wrote about in the last 50 years in Wisconsin sports history. Well, let's get to some on the list. This one, number 12, we'll give a listen here. Ryan Braun helping clinch a playoff spot against the Cubs. There's the Cubs again in 2008.
And there's a drive in the left field. This is hit well, and it's gone! Ryan Braun! A two-run home run! The Brewers take the lead!
All right, we don't have a Brewers World Series win to put on the list, but this was a pretty good Brewers moment, JR.
If I were making a list of my personal moments, honestly, that'd be top three at least. I haven't been around for all of the moments on this list, so it's probably unfair, but... That was a very meaningful moment to me. I tell this joke, and it's old, and my wife, if she hears it, will roll her eyes. But I always say, I got married September 20th, 2008, and the greatest day of my life happened 10 days later when the Milwaukee Brewers went to the playoffs for the first time in my lifetime. Or, you know, I was born in 82, but obviously not aware of what was going on. That was a huge breakthrough, and I really wanted to rank it higher. Just didn't feel like I could with some of the things that were in that, you know, those top 12 spots. But some of the moments are just plain old breakthroughs. And yeah, the Brewers didn't get beyond the first round of the playoffs that year, but it isn't about the stage they ended up on. It was about snapping that 26-year drought and doing so in tremendously dramatic fashion. That home run, Sabathia finishing the game, CC Sabathia finishing that game with a very memorable double play to end it. And there are other items on the list as well, like, you know, the Badgers winning the 94 Rose Bowl, the 93 season. You know, the Badgers have been back to Rose Bowl since then. That might theoretically take some of the shine away from that moment, but it still was so meaningful in the moment and so important for the Badgers to break through the way they did. So that's obviously something I'm weighing as I'm trying to lay these out.
And let's clarify, you're happy because you were married and the Brewers went to the playoffs, right? This is like both together that made this such a special day.
Yes, and obviously okay. It is just a joke, but that was a very memorable stretch of September for yours truly.
All right, you've got a lot of Packers in the top spot. Let's, spoiler alert, this one's number one. Here's a listen to the number one moment in your top 50 here.
Kick goes to Desmond Howard at the one. Desmond Howard is off. You better turn it on or he's gone. Desmond Howard. The Patriot end zone. As soon as they get back in it, Green Bay takes it away. 99 yards.
And that was at not just a Super Bowl winning play in effect, but it was at a pivotal moment in the game.
Yeah, the Patriots had just scored and kind of taken some momentum, and then Desmond Howard's immortal kickoff return. You know, it's on the cover of Sports Illustrated the following week with the moniker Special Team. And no secret that the Packers are king. If we're talking about, you know, any sort of sports ranking in Wisconsin, Packers are always going to get some preferential treatment. So I think there's four Packers moments in the top six on my list. And I think that's probably right. And certainly winning a Super Bowl is kind of the pinnacle. If that's the biggest sport in Wisconsin, then it's, you know, winning a Super Bowl is the biggest achievement. I when I made my list, I ran it by people, you know, people within my organization and some other people I just trust. And to a man of the people I asked, what do you think is number one or should be number one? Everybody said the Super Bowl after the 1996 season, sort of that return to title town for the Green Bay Packers. And obviously the moment that goes with that is Desmond Howard's kickoff return. There are a lot of exciting moments in that game. There's an 81-yard touchdown pass from Favre to Antonio Freeman where he's running up the field all excited. Actually, I think the running up the field is a different touchdown. That's the one to Rison. In any event, there's a lot to remember from that game. And there's, you know, that's to me, that was an easy call as number one.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hi there, guys. How you doing today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Mike?
Just curious. Is Game 7 of the 82 ALCS on your list?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You're talking about Game 5 of 82.
Oop. No, go ahead,
game
Mike.
Game 5 of 82.
I was going to say that was actually the day I was born.
And what are your biggest memories from that game, Mike? I'm just kidding.
My memories, my mom's got better memories of that day. 35 hours of labor, they had to get a surgery crew in Appleton Memorial Hospital. She said when I entered the world, the living room smelled like pepperoni pizza and Miller High Life.
Mike, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Born with that one. Did you say you were born in 82, JR?
I was indeed. I was born in February of that year, so nothing magical on that day that I know of anyway in Wisconsin sports history. But a few months later, the World Series for the Milwaukee Brewers.
Well, a great birthday present for you, Mike. We are talking to J.R. Radcliffe, trending sports reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at his list of the 50 greatest moments in Wisconsin sports in the last 50 years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Wisconsin sports memory? What makes it special for you? Were you there maybe in person for a great moment in Wisconsin sports? What do you think deserves to be on the list? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about Wisconsin's most memorable sports moments with J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A lot of big news out there. We're taking a break, having some fun looking back at state sports history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would make it on your list of the state's greatest sports moments? J.R. focused on the last 50 years. If you got one earlier than that, we'll take it. 800-642-1234. Pro baseball, basketball, football, if you want, college, wherever you want to go, Olympics, big Wisconsin Olympics moments, call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls again. Bill is with us now in Eau Claire. Bill, hi.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had the quarterback sneak by Bart Starr in the Ice Bowl on your list. I'd put that up there pretty high, maybe even number one.
Thank you for that call. I bet if you did an all-time list, JR, there's a strong case for number one. I think that comes in before your 50-year cutoff.
It does indeed, yeah, since it happens before 1970. And I, you know, there are a few reasons I picked that 50-year window, but he's absolutely right. You can't
– Oh, yeah.
I mean, if I made a list all-time, you'd have to go with the Ice Bowl number one. There's just nothing else that could possibly take its place. And I didn't – you know, it wasn't necessarily intentional to cut out the Lombardi years, but I knew that if I went back too far, I'd be a little bit out of my depth. And you know, I'm already writing about things that I wasn't alive for if I'm writing about things in the 70s and very early 80s. But and that's fine. You know, it's all research based anyway. But if I go back too far, it starts to get really muddy. You get a lot of moments from those Packers championship teams that have to be considered way, way up there. But at the same time, it's difficult to grade those on a curve and try to imagine what would those moments be like today? How would they stack up against, you know, some of the things that we've seen in the most recent 50 years. But obviously those Packers championship teams would have been hogging the spotlight if I'm trying to make an all-time list. You get a lot of greatness prior to that 50-year window cutoff.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Pat in Three Lakes now. Pat, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I heard you mention that if you went back in the Lombardi era, it would be kind of muddy. I'll go back to the Ice Bowl. I was there with a group of people from Milwaukee. A guy by the name of Lee Martin got us a bunch of tickets. We all worked for Taylor Electric Company, and we took a bus down to Green Bay, and we watched the game. The beer actually froze in our cups. You know, you probably heard that, but that was true. And, he got so cold, he went down into the bathroom, and the bathroom stunk so bad that you had to come out of there. We were at the game, and after the game, we went down on the field, and I don't know if you noticed that, but we pulled the goalpost down. But it was quite a memory, you know. It's so long ago. It seems like yesterday.
Wow, Pat, thank you so much for sharing that. That's a great memory, JR. Since you wrote this series, as you're writing pieces, did you hear back from people who had been at some of the moments you talked about?
Definitely a lot of people, a lot of emails. It's been awesome. I mean, it sucks that we're in this place in the world. And I know that there's, you know, the circumstances that kind of gave birth to this series are sort of, you know, obviously a big bummer, but it's been really cool to hear from people that are just looking for something different to read about, you know, some trips down memory lane. You know, I have heard from people who are suggesting moments, you know, moments sometimes that fit the window, sometimes don't, but it's been great. Lots of positive feedback, some negative too, which is to be expected and totally welcome. But yes, as far as the Ice Bowl, my grandparents, I once interviewed them. They themselves attended the Ice Bowl.
Wow.
And you know, I once found myself, I was like, did you really attend the Ice Bowl? Because a lot of people say they did, and I'm not 100% certain I can trust you guys, but they gave me their story as well, which I'm sure is very similar to a lot of other people. And I put that into a story. So yeah, I'm as fascinated by the Ice Bowl as anything.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Taking your great Wisconsin sports memories, J.R. Radcliffe of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel focused on the last 50 years. You can go beyond that if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Taking a break from some of the big news out there. Ed is with us now in West Dallas. Ed, hi.
Good afternoon. I want to go back to sort of a sad day, September 24th, 1965. The last home game for the Milwaukee Braves. It was important because Frank Bolling hit a grand slam home run off of Sandy Koufax. Sandy Koufax didn't even get out of the third inning that night, but the game went 11 innings. Lou Johnson for the Dodgers hit two home runs late in the game, and they tied it up at the top of the 11th. And in the bottom of the 11th, the Braves were behind a run. Aaron hit a double, but he passed Mac Jones on the base pass because of a coaching error by Dixie Walker.
Oh, no.
And he was thrown out at first base to end the game. So September 24th, 1965.
Ed, thank you so much for that. And it's not, wow, talk about it feels like only yesterday. It sounds like it was only yesterday for Ed. Now, that of course, was before your time range, JR. But you look at some non-on-the-field moments involving things like stadiums, because he was talking about the last day there at the park. What were a couple of those sort of off-the-field moments you included in your list?
Well, one of them kind of ties in. I guess this is on the field as well, but I did mention a little bit about that final game in 1965 in the 1970 moment when baseball does come back to Milwaukee, because obviously the Braves leaving left a really deep scar in the Milwaukee sports community. It's felt by a lot of people still today. I mean, there's a lot of people that are still burned by Milwaukee, you know, losing its baseball team and being quiet for 5 years. So Bud Selig bringing the team back was a huge boost to the morale of the community. And obviously the Brewers have had some success, especially lately in the 50 years since. You know, this was supposed to be their 50th anniversary celebration. So that was one thing related to the Brewers. There was another, I think, a pretty famous story at this point. George Petak, a Racine government official who changed his vote at the last second to really approve, you know, a financing plan for Miller Park. And had he not done that, there is some question as to whether or not the Brewers would have been able to stay in Milwaukee. County Stadium was very old at that point, wasn't really the right fit to sustain a baseball team. And without Miller Park, it's easy to wonder where the Brewers would be, if they would still be in Milwaukee or if they would have gotten the stadium financing done eventually. But George Petak faced a recall election, actually lost his spot because he wound up supporting that. The Racine people did not want to be part of that financing plan. And so moments like that make the list. Jane Pettit donating the Bradley Center at a time again when the Bucks needed a new venue, and she just forked over the money to do it, basically, and gave it to the city of Milwaukee, a major gesture for pro sports in Milwaukee. So those are a couple things on the list as well. For the most part, you're getting mostly on-field events.
Sure.
Because of what we talked about earlier. Though it's hard to universally experience something that isn't happening right in front of our eyes, but obviously those are major moments in Wisconsin sports history.
Well, we've focused a lot on baseball and football, a little basketball. How about some Olympic moments that you share in your series?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really do it without some of the Wisconsin Olympians, particularly those who wear skates. In the top 10, I got Eric Heiden winning 5 gold medals at the 1980 Olympics. He's a really interesting story. Really interesting. I mean, he really didn't want anything to do with being a star. You know, he didn't want, you know, he didn't want a lengthy career after those Olympics as just being a guy that people knew and that appeared on Wheaties boxes and stuff. He wasn't into any of that. He competed in one Winter Olympics and won 5 gold medals. I think the craziest part of the story is that he's actually physically at Miracle on Ice the night before he skates for his 5th and final gold medal. He is at that game and then wakes up late the next day to get ready to, you know, to get ready to hit the speed skating rink. But then Miracle on Ice in and of itself has to be on there because Wisconsin's own Mark Johnson scores 2 goals in that memorable game against the Soviet Union. And so he's mentioned as well. I think I have him at number 15. He's a little, if we were making a list of like, you know, sports moments that incorporate, there aren't many lists where Miracle on Ice wouldn't be at the top of a list like this, basically. But I felt like it wasn't as much a Wisconsin moment as it was a United States moment. So I dropped it a little bit out of the top 10, but certainly Mark Johnson's contribution, Bob Suter was on the team as well. Another Wisconsin Badger. Without those guys, it doesn't happen. So they have to be mentioned as well.
A listener named Jeff wanted to give a shout out to Wisconsin's curling prowess and pointed to Matt Hamilton's gold at the Olympics as well. Some more great Olympic moments there. All right, I want to wrap this up, JR, by asking you if you could pick, with the power of time travel, being able to go back and witness any of these moments in person, when and where do you go?
I would 100% want to be in 1971 witnessing the greatness of Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, sort of his maturation into one of maybe the greatest player in NBA history, or at least definitely on the short list. The 1971 Bucks team, I had them as my number 4 moment. I did end up elevating, one of your callers earlier mentioned that game 5 of the ALCS. I did put that at number 3, but the Bucks winning the 71 championship was about as dominant as it gets. And this town, they just got basketball. You know, it was a 3-year-old franchise at that point. And he comes in and he's such a difference maker that he takes an expansion franchise and turns them into a world champion. And they just crushed Baltimore. Actually, Wes Unseld, one of the great Bullets members of the Bullets organization, just passed away, I believe, yesterday or today. And he was the fact that the Bucks were able to just eviscerate them and win that first championship. And sort of crazy that they didn't win another one. They went back to the finals in 1974, but could not replicate that. So I would love to see that.
JR, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
That's JR Radcliffe, trending sports reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about his series, counting down the 50 best Wisconsin sports moments of the last 50 years. The news is next. Then stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Trump is threatening to use the U.S. military to end looting and rioting in American cities. We'll take a look at the powers presidents do and don't have in these situations coming up. First, many communities across the country, including places like Madison and Milwaukee, recently chose to close several selected city streets and parkways to vehicle traffic during the COVID-19 pandemic. The idea was to open them up to walkers, runners, and bikers. Robert Schneider is an associate professor in the UW-Milwaukee Department of Urban Planning, specializing in sustainable transportation, modeling, and safety analysis. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, why did we see cities like Milwaukee and Madison and others around the country make this change, closing down streets completely or in part to vehicle traffic?
Well, the most recent change really has to do with the inspiration of making sure our communities are as healthy as possible. In response to COVID-19, making sure that people have space to physically separate from each other. That includes expanding out on where people might be from sidewalks and trails. One thing that we saw in March and April in our region and in many other parts of the country were very high trail counts. Our trail counts were 50 to 100% higher around our region than they were the year before. In March and April. And so there's just many people trying to get out, but it's really important that they have more physical distance with them, between them, so that they wouldn't spread the coronavirus.
And Milwaukee's campaign is called Active Streets. How did they decide, how do communities like this decide, you know, which streets or which lanes they can get some mileage out of by closing them down?
Well, there's a couple of factors that they think about. One has to do with the type of street, that is places that are not they're not main thoroughfares. These are mostly residential streets where there's many people who'd want to get out for a walk, many who are working at home, many who just don't have that much space to get out to a local park. These streets, especially in Milwaukee, have been chosen so that they could connect people from their houses to a nearby park and to take advantage of that open space and have plenty of space along the way to get there. There are other cities around the country that I think weren't even as deliberate as the city of Milwaukee was about making sure that they were spread throughout neighborhoods across the city, serving people of all income, all racial backgrounds. And so the city here did a great job of thinking about equity when they were choosing their locations as well.
On the flip side, some people might hear this and think, wait a minute, I got to make sure I can drive to my work, my house, whatever. How do they make sure they aren't cutting off important lanes for people who need to drive in them?
For sure. Emergency vehicles are allowed through these streets. People who need to get to their homes, they're very much allowed to use the streets in a car. Delivery vehicles, they are still open to those sorts of traffic. They're just closed to through vehicle traffic, and so basically open to everybody else who's on foot, on bicycle, on rollerblades, et cetera. So yes, safety and essential workers and emergency vehicles are very important to keep going these days. So they made sure not to impact those, as well as bus routes. Those are not locations where you have these types of streets.
And we've talked some about Wisconsin's two biggest cities. Is this something that small or mid-sized communities could benefit from as well?
It is. It has been less common in some of the smaller villages and towns. But in other parts of the country, there are smaller cities that are looking at this sort of type of change, not always in just a residential street, but also looking at their commercial areas and where they might expand sidewalk space by removing automobile parking from the curbside and extending a place for outdoor dining. There's several tourist towns, Exeter, New Hampshire, Rockland, Maine, Port Townsend, Washington. These are places that have done street changes like this, but they're very small types of communities. They're not the big cities.
Talking to Robert Schneider from the UW-Milwaukee Department of Urban Planning, looking at some communities in Wisconsin and around the country closing some lanes of traffic or some streets to only local vehicle traffic to open up more room for people to walk and bike, happening largely in response to the COVID-19 outbreak, as people, you know, want to get some exercise outside but don't want to be too packed in on that sidewalk. Bob, is this something you think might continue even hopefully sooner than later when we're not as worried about COVID-19?
Yeah, there's been some positive evidence from the San Francisco Bay Area, where some of the first active streets initiatives were in place. Oakland, California has now done about 20 miles of what they call their slow street network. And that has received a fairly positive response from the community. 75% of people who've been surveyed were saying, yes, this is a good thing. And so the city is looking at doing a more permanent version of these slow streets, which is related to some planning efforts that have been going on for a number of years in quite a few cities around the country, not just Oakland, but places like Portland, Seattle, Minneapolis. These are places that have planned things called neighborhood greenways or bicycle boulevards. And these are basically the same sort of concept, where it's a slow speed residential street. Local traffic is still allowed, but cut through automobile traffic is discouraged. And so we see lots of bicycling and lots of positive response from neighbors for these types of neighborhood greenways. Milwaukee is actually planning a couple of them. Madison has several. East Mifflin Street is an example that's currently being used as a slow street. So as planning is going on for neighborhood greenways, there's an advantage. There's the ability to take advantage of that planning and say, hey, let's do this fairly quickly on a temporary basis and see how well it works.
We've talked to you on the past, Bob, about the risk of bicycle fatalities in Wisconsin and a study you were involved in, I think, that showed, you know, a huge percentage of drivers don't slow down for pedestrians at crosswalks. Is there, do you think, a culture shift we need to make sure that, you know, people in getting around in ways other than in cars are safe and have space on our roadways?
Yes, this is the active streets that are happening here in Milwaukee, and slow streets in other parts of the country are part of a broader rethinking of how we use our streets, which are truly public spaces. So we as a community ultimately get to decide how we want our streets to be used. And through public discussion and ultimately testing out some different ways of using streets, we can explore more creative ways than just saying, well, every street should be for moving cars as fast as possible. These active streets are a way of testing out an option that allows people to be walking and biking more in the street, and says basically through signage, automobiles, you're not the priority on this street. It's people walking and people biking. That itself is sending a message that the social norm for this particular street is a little bit different than others. And, you know, it really remains to be seen how much people will like this. But so far, the results from Oakland, you know, my local neighborhood here, which has two of the active streets, has had a very positive response. And drivers, as I've been going along with my kids along the street, one, my four-year-old, she rides on her tricycle, or sorry, her bike with training wheels, and 1.5-year-old rides on his tricycle. As we're in the street, cars go very slowly behind us, and they ring their bells, and we wave, and, you know, there's a really nice social interaction that happens, of course, at a physical distance, but a nice community interaction happening there.
We'll leave it there. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
That's Robert Schneider, associate professor in the UW-Milwaukee Department of Urban Planning. He specializes in sustainable transportation, modeling, and safety analysis. He joined us to talk about cities in Wisconsin and elsewhere closing down some streets or lanes to most vehicle traffic and opening them up for people to walk, run, and bike. Coming up, we'll look at the possibility of President Trump using the military to try to end violent unrest in U.S. cities. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you break for garage sales? If so, you may be doing less of that this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, at least so far. We'll talk about the outlook for garage sales, flea markets, and more this summer coming up. Now, active duty troops are standing by outside of Washington, D.C., waiting for a potential order from President Trump to crack down on protesters. Yesterday, Trump declared himself the, quote, president of law and order, end quote. He said if cities and states aren't willing to establish, quote, an overwhelming law enforcement presence, he's prepared to take action.
I am mobilizing all available federal resources, civilian and military, to stop the rioting and looting, to end the destruction and arson, and to protect the rights of law-abiding Americans, including your Second Amendment rights.
The violence follows last week's death of George Floyd while in Minneapolis police custody. Since then, peaceful demonstrations have taken place in cities across the country, but so has looting and rioting, including in Madison and Milwaukee. So what powers do presidents have when it comes to sending troops to American cities? Gordon Adams is a professor emeritus of U.S. foreign policy at American University. His areas of expertise include defense and national security. Gordon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to join you, Rob.
Well, I've been looking online at arguments among legal experts with different answers to the question, can the president do this? What is your read on this, Gordon?
Well, it depends on what this is, because there are at least a couple of laws that apply to this particular type of situation. You know, scholars are going to disagree on where the effectiveness is. There's something that we passed way back in 1878 called the Posse Comitatus Act. And the Posse Comitatus Act, passed in the wake of the Civil War, basically says you can't use the federal military to execute the law in any given state. And that's been the sort of basic legal prohibition on using force. It doesn't mean you can't deploy the military. It doesn't mean you can't do a natural disaster type relief, National Guard. All those kinds of things can happen, and they do. Lots of history of that. But the critical legal distinction that the Posse Comitatus Act sets up is saying the military cannot perform policing functions, that is to say, execute the law. They can't go out and arrest people. They can't apply laws to people when they're used in any internal situation. And that's, you know, been used most of the time to keep a norm intact. And the norm is we don't really use the military to enforce order in the United States. Now, there are exceptions to this, and the biggest exception is the other law. It's called the Insurrection Act, which was originally passed in 1807, believe it or not, and amended in 2006. So it's a law still on the books, and it has been used. And under the Insurrection Act, it is possible to bring in the military with constraints on their use to execute the laws, but to establish order. In the first case, under one of the provisions of the Insurrection Act, the military would be brought in at the request of a state legislature or in the absence of convening the legislature, the governor. And the military would come in and be used for that purpose. The most noticeable instance recently of the Insurrection Act being used under those circumstances was probably the Los Angeles riots in 1993, I think it was. When the military was brought in Los Angeles and did help establish order. But even there, the military was very careful, active duty military. This is not federalizing the Guard. I mean, you have to make a distinction here because the National Guard at the state level can be used by governors to execute the laws. But if the president nationalizes, federalizes the National Guard, then the Posse Comitatus restrictions apply. And in Los Angeles, the commander of the exercise in Los Angeles basically said, we will use the military up to the point of actually arresting people. That belongs to the local police. So he behaved according to the norms that provision of the Insurrection Act. The other part of the Insurrection Act, though, says the president can on his own, and this is what people are relying on politically right now. It's what Senator Cotton called for and others. It says the president may, under circumstances where it's impracticable for any state to enforce the law, the president may call into federal service the militia of any state, meaning the National Guard, or use the federal military to enforce the laws or suppress the rebellion. Right? Anything that's an unlawful obstruction, combination, assemblage, or rebellion against the authority of the United States. That's the provision that it seems the Trump administration wants to invoke here if governors don't ask for it. Governors previously have asked for it. Blanco in Catarina asked for it. Governor Romney, Mitt, his father, when governor of Michigan, called it into Detroit. There are plenty of cases where that first provision has been executed. It's rare, extremely rare, the second provision to be executed.
I wanted to dig into a comment from Senator Cotton of Arkansas. You mentioned in his tweets calling for the use of various military units, he ended by saying they should apply, I'm going to quote here, no quarter for insurrectionists, anarchists, rioters, and looters. No quarter people might use colloquially. It has a legal and military meaning, I think, that people say is pretty disturbing.
Well, it means the lethal use of force, basically.
And without accepting surrender.
No quarter means no quarter. It means you don't accept surrender. You shoot people, basically. You kill people. And that, Senator Cotton is simply out to lunch, not to use a colloquial phrase, because even if you deploy the forces into a situation like this, there are standing rules with respect to how force can be used in responding to civil unrest in the United States. They're called Standing Rules for the Use of Force, SRUF, and they are fairly careful, those rules, right? They have to do with using force as the last resort and force as the minimum necessary. And finally, deadly force is to be used only when all lesser means have failed or cannot be reasonably employed. In other words, in the guidance of the Pentagon, this is no longer the law, but this is the standing rules that the Pentagon has in place, that they tailor to individual circumstances. But it would be extremely unusual. I dare say practically unprecedented for Senator Cotton to have his wet dream of having the military walk in shooting and taking down looters and people demonstrating and people torching stores or looting or whatever they're doing without any imposition of standing rules. Those are long existing precedent in the use of force in the United States. And the only time that force is authorized under the rules of force, including deadly force, under those standing rules, is with respect to three specified assets, right? Assets vital to national security, and that means things like nuclear command posts and control facilities, or inherently dangerous property like missiles, rockets, explosives, if somebody's attacking a military base with a bunch of insurgents. And thirdly, national critical infrastructure, meaning public utilities. So people are attacking, you know, the telephone lines and taking down the water pumps, then, you know, there's a provision that allows deadly force to be considered. But again, it's not Senator Cotton's greatest desire. You know, it's not going in and establishing order by killing people. It's literally forces of order working within standing rules. So there's a, you know, it just strikes me, Rob, there's a lot of rhetoric around this that's tough guy rhetoric that doesn't really understand either the provisions of law or the rules of engagement for the uses of the military.
Talking to Gordon Adams from American University about the president's threat to send armed forces, federal armed forces, into cities around the country. I want to quote Congressman Adam Smith, Democrat chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, quoting, "The domestic deployment of our armed services is an incredibly serious undertaking that should not be taken lightly." He goes on, "It is un-American to use our service members to dominate civilians, as both the president and Secretary of Defense have suggested. We live in a democracy, not a dictatorship." So how do we evaluate if this particular situation, the protests and then the looting around the country, is a point where we want to invoke the Insurrection Act? Is it the right thing to do?
It's hard for me to judge because I don't have the detailed knowledge of the situations in each of the places where there are activities like this going on. Obviously, Minneapolis is the core of this, some activity in Los Angeles as well, as I understand it. But mostly, for the most part, what we have is angry, but basically peaceful demonstrations. They fall far short of the early 1990s Los Angeles riots or the Detroit riots. They're way, way short of anything that has been ultimately, that these laws have been used in order to bring in the uniformed military. My back of the envelope judgment here is no. And if you are going to require something more than the National Guard, right, then you have a choice. Either the governors, as some have brought in, as they have in Minneapolis, have brought in the National Guard to help maintain order in the streets, or you can federalize the National Guard, as the president has the authority to do, and bring them in under federal authority, whether the governors want to have them or not, under the Insurrection Act. But there's very little here that says to me that there's a justification for bringing in military force. The rhetoric far surpasses what I think the real risk here is. And it gets worse when you have somebody like the Secretary of Defense basically saying dominate the battlefield, which he was recorded as having said to the governors, that we should use military force to dominate the battlefield. That's what governors ought to be doing. This is not a battlefield, not in any statutory or legal or even military sense of the term. It is unruly civil unrest. That is true. And it's not unprecedented in the United States. But the first recourse for any of this is at the local police level and the state National Guard level. And those instruments are being used. They have not been fully tested here. And it strikes me as political advantage by people like Cotton, and yes, the president himself, is being taken with respect to the reaction to basically the brutal killing of a citizen in Minneapolis. So I don't think we're anywhere near the point where we have a broad-based civil insurrection across the United States that requires the use of the military. And Americans have had a norm for a long time about being very careful about when and how we use America's military. And there's a very long history that goes way back to the Constitution.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Gordon Adams, Professor Emeritus of U.S. Foreign Policy at American University. We talked to him about President Trump's threat to use the military to end looting and rioting, he says, in U.S. cities after protests of the death of George Floyd. Usually the big Scripps National Spelling Bee happens around this time of year. They canceled it this year because of the coronavirus, and our friends at 1A had a good conversation about spelling bees a week or two back. On a related note, new information from Google tells us which words give us a hard time to spell, broken down state by state. Google released the most common words and searches so far in 2020, asking, how do you spell this? And they have a state-by-state map. They tweeted it out. I think you can find it elsewhere, too. In a number of states, including Minnesota, the number one topic so far, the number one word, was quarantine. That makes sense. Very, very topical. A lot of states, including Michigan, were looking for the spelling of the word canceled. And that's when I have to think about one L or two. It's two. For our other neighbors, Iowa wants to know how to spell choir. Illinois wants to spell beautiful. Those are legit. I don't know how often they come up, but neither of them is spelled the way it sounds. Okay, so here in Wisconsin, we keep asking how to spell the word illustrator. And the reason for that is, I have no idea. We're the only state in the union that had illustrator as our number one spelling check word. And I can't think of a reason why that would be so in demand. I get the spelling question, O or E at the end. It's O. One or two L's, it's two. But was there an illustrator convention, or was illustrator a big word in online lesson plans? It'll remain a mystery. This is Central Time with one E, I guess two. This is the Ideas Network.